Welcome to Do Different Better Show, where we talk about wealth wisdom and money moves, making finance simple for everyday people. I'm your host, Elaine Rasmussen, founder and CEO of Social Impact Now, Connect Up Institute, and general partner of the Integrated Capital Fund. Thank you for joining me today. In our last episode, we talked about my own personal journey on struggles with the trauma of money. This week, we are talking about lending and borrowing, and you're going to meet two people who are working to make a difference in how to bring economic justice to finance. My guests today are Chelsea McDaniel, Director of Impact Investing, and Christina Lara Agudelo, you have to correct me, manager of Lending Partnerships of Common Future. So my first guest, I'm going to give a little bit of bio, and then I'm going to turn it over to them to give a little bit of introduction of themselves. Christina is the Lending Partnership Manager of Common Future. She supports Common Future's impact investing team by working with community-rooted organizations to co-create loan funds that increase access and affordability and shift power and choice and ownership to communities. She's passionate about ensuring the economy serves all. Prior to Common Future, Christina was the program manager for Economic Inequity Inequality Initiative at Uncharted, where she designed and executed a six-month accelerator program for entrepreneurs working to close the wealth gap in the United States. And we'll hear more about Chelsea in just a moment. First of all, I want to ask both of you to, well, I'll start with Chelsea. Tell us a little bit about who you are, where you work, and what do you do there?
Great. First of all, thanks for having us. Chelsea McDaniel, I'm the Director of Impact Investments at Common Future. I oversee our partnerships, which Christina will talk to you a little bit more about later, and our intermediated investments, where we're working with first-time or early-stage fund managers to get them patient capital with flexible terms, basically so they can do the work they need to do in community.
Awesome. Thank you. And Christina, tell us a little bit more about what you do. I read your bio, but let's get a little bit more sticky.
Yeah, thanks, Elaine. And I'm super excited to be here. Like you mentioned, I'm the Lending Partnerships Manager at Common Future. I've had a couple of roles here at Common Future since I came over in the merger with Uncharted. I've been here for about 2 years since then. As a Lending Partnerships Manager, I really try to work with a lot of our lending partners, current and potential, to make sure that their loan funds are running well and that we're measuring the impact of their portfolios, as well as with new potential partners to co-create the terms and the underwriting criteria for really effective loan funds that get capital into the communities that we want to see more capital and better capital in as well.
Thank you. That's amazing. And we will definitely talk about how we actually know each other. So first I want to, you know, we'll get into more details about the work. But first, in last week's episode, I shared a lot about how I landed into social impact and social finance and social finance work. Christina, how did you get into social impact?
After I graduated from business school, I knew I wanted to be in social impact, but many of the resources for this line of work were not really available at my institution, which I was a little disappointed at. But I decided to do a year of service with AmeriCorps, where I taught seventh grade math in Wilmington, Delaware. And after finishing up my year of service, I got an offer to join an organization called Uncharted, which now no longer exists because we're under the same umbrella as Common Future. And I worked on their community engagement and collective impact team, where I supported very hyper-local projects in Denver, Colorado, that empowered local residents to really take ownership of what our acceleration ecosystem looked like there. And then I went on to help design and build our Economic Inequality Accelerator Program, which now still exists kind of in the Common Future realm. And I'm happy to talk about that a little bit later when we talk about Common Future. And then at Common Future, I started off supporting our participatory investing work, creating a toolkit on how funders could implement participatory investing into their work before moving on to the investments team.
And I want to put a pin in that participatory funding. I think that's going to be an interesting concept that we can talk a little bit more about as well. And Chelsea, how did you get into finance?
Yeah, mine was a little bit more of a wandering path, maybe a lost, maybe I was lost for a little bit, hence the wandering. I was thinking about this and I think I really started like organizing around community and particularly community environmental rights. I grew up in Sacramento, California, right next to a levee. And it seemed that there were always developers trying to build there without very many precautions. And usually it was black and brown folks going there. So I remember at like 15, like testifying about that and, wouldn't have connected that to any kind of future organizing, gosh, finance work. But when I think back, that's probably when it started. And then from there, sort of did some different work around environmental and community organizing for a number of years, and kept seeing how, on the one end, we had at that time sort of this emerging ESG or environmental social governance movement that was really focused more on like governments and businesses, trying to get in better relationship in those three areas, environmental, social, and governance. And then I was also seeing nonprofits and community organizations that oftentimes were deeply undercapitalized, but just trying and figuring out ways to have this tremendous impact and meet community needs. So something in that I think area of how are we financing the things that community actually needs to be able to build and have this positive impact sent me back to business school. Yeah, from there, I think I really had a chance to delve into this world. I mean, gosh, it's like a couple years ago now, that was, I think, still emerging, this kind of impact finance space. And there were people who were actually blending the two and trying to figure out how we do properly capitalize like programs and initiatives and and entities that were working for community benefit. So I got to do that in a number of different ways. I worked for an organization, small startup that was working on municipal bonds in Black cities and organizing around kind of public money that way. And then recently came on board with Common Future about 6 months ago, and get to oversee all of our investments, both in the partnerships where we work more closely with partners who have a really good understanding and strong understanding of what the community needs are and what the financial gaps are and help them kind of bring a fund to life. And then working with folks who are first-time fund managers, and standing that up and really stepping into partnership with them and saying, instead of just seeing the risk, we see all the possibility here.
Yeah, one of the things that I find is that everyone I know that does this work, including myself, as Chelsea pointed out, we've all kind of like ended up here. There's no college degree for this kind of work. Everyone I know has fallen into the work by some happenstance path. It's, with Christina, it started off with teaching math, right? With me, when I was 18, I started off as a stock analyst, left finance, went in pursuit of 25-year career in marketing and communications. And it was just through some happenstance, found myself in rooms talking about impact investing. I'm like, well, wait a minute. I have a little bit of a finance background, and it seems like what they're talking about really is not impact, and really just starting my inquiry from there. So I find that that's a real common thread with both of you, but also with other folks that I know that are in this field. And I find it fascinating that how we just all kind of like umbrella parachute in to this universe that, quite frankly, one, wasn't really set up to include us, right? And two, can still be, there's a lot of knowledge protection. And so we're having to like beat down these doors to really kind of figure out how do these things work. There's so many things that are just unsaid. But I want to move on and really kind of get into maybe your own personal story. And this is for whomever would like to answer the question. Think about and share with our listeners, what was your first memory of money, or when did you realize that money had influence? Christina, Chelsea?
Yeah, sure. I'm happy to take that. I think my first memory around money was when my family and I immigrated to Canada from Colombia when I was six. And I remember that my parents had shipped some of our belongings from Colombia on a boat, like you used to do, kind of moving across the world. But the packages were super delayed, like several months. And I remember kind of having new friends from school or people that I didn't really know in the community drop off. It was so nice, drop off toys, clothes, and like household items to hold us over while our stuff came. And I, at first, I didn't really think that I realized like why we had to get help from other people. But my parents like began to explain that the cost of things in Canada was much higher than the cost in Colombia. So our lives began to look really, really different than when we were in Colombia and moved to Canada. And I think that realization about the different like purchasing power that you have in different countries was when I was like first realizing that this was conversations that my parents were having for months, but were only just beginning to affect my brother and I. And so I think that's like when I understood a little bit about that.
Yeah, that had to have been a very stark experience. Even as a young person, you have lived a life in a certain way, and then all of a sudden, it's a very different. And you know that there's a difference, but you're not really sure. And then you start to learn, like, oh, there's this thing that's called money that shows up in your life, and it's happening to you, right? As opposed to you having any sort of agency in it, right? And so when you think about, and this is once again for either of you, when you think about the cultural norms that you've had to navigate coming from Colombia, possibly to Canada, or Chelsea, if you want to jump in here, what are the cultural norms or trauma that you've had to navigate through even doing this work, working with funders who have these lots of money and power and or perceived power, actually? And then we're working with some of the folks that are dealing with some of the same stuff we're dealing with. What have you seen or what have you experienced? Either one. It doesn't. Who would like to answer it?
I think one of the most interesting things that has come up working with funders and working on other sides outside of this role of fundraising and in different positions has been that there are these really strong held perceptions of risk. And so there's some, you know, brilliant academics who've kind of coined the idea of a black tax, particularly as it relates to municipal bonds. But I think it's, you know, it's constant throughout our financial system. And it's the way that risk is priced in, right? And the assumption of risk with racialized people. But that comes up in one-on-one conversations too. And so even in 2020, 2021, you know, folks are so excited, really, really wanting to align their investments with investing in particularly Black communities, but BIPOC communities more broadly. And yet the one-on-one conversations lead with, it's almost as if they're talking out of both sides of their mouth. You know, we'd really like to do this. My gosh, is this going to be dangerous? You know, what are some of the risks? How could we possibly scale this? And the same line of thinking that they almost folks can't get out of their way with that. And so I think, that idea of like the maybe long legacy of unworthiness and not of perceived risk. And I don't mean unworthiness in that these communities haven't been worthy of that, but that has been baked into our financial institutions from the beginning. I think it was a little bit jarring to see how present that still was, right, in the current day. And it's a huge thing to kind of overcome. So we found that like educating folks where they're at and really naming that perception of risk and how that's not reality, and even reorienting how folks are seeing that and what they're bringing and how they can show up as partners who more, I think at the, you know, the maybe further along are like, what's the risk of not doing this? All these perceived risks I have of this community.
Yeah. Exactly. Or unknown perceived risk, right? I just had somebody yesterday, I was doing a capital readiness accelerator, and I was talking with folks, and they were telling me how recently they had gotten emails. Basically, one person had said this person had put together a beautiful business plan, and the result was this person saying, after months and months and months of not responding to this entrepreneur, this Black female entrepreneur was like, yeah, I never really looked at it because I really didn't think that it was really going to go anywhere. And put that in email, put that in writing And so I said to this person, I would send that to the president of that financial institution. I mean, it's not because you want something to them to do something about it as far as lending, you know, considering you for a loan or considering you for a line of credit, but to put them on notice, right? To let them know. Well, you have been listening to Do Different Better with Elaine Rasmussen, your host. Coming up next, we'll be talking about the work of Common Future and how they are powering new lending practices. Welcome back to Do Different Better. I'm your host, Elaine Rasmussen. We've been talking to Chelsea McDaniel, Director of Impact Investing, and Cristina Lara Agudelo, Manager of Lending Partnerships of Common Future. And we've been talking about their money journey. Now let's talk a little bit more about the work of Common Future and kind of what's happening in the larger finance ecosystem. So, Cristina, tell us more about the mission and the goals of Common Future, particularly in relation to social finance and impact investing.
Yeah, Common Future is on a mission to build a future where all people, no matter race and class, have power, choice, and ownership over the economy. And to effectively advance racial and economic equity, we incubate, co-create, and fund field-defining initiatives and actively influence key sectors of our economy, of finance, of the way that we work in kind of our entrepreneurial ecosystems, and things like that as well.
So how does Common Future support community-led solutions and innovations like initiatives? What do you actually do? How do you make that happen?
Yeah, so Common Future definitely supports community-led initiatives and solutions. And we do that. Chelsea and I work on the investment side of Common Future. I'll let Chelsea explain a little bit more about our intermediated investments, but we also have kind of our lending partnership side. So our investments team is split into two. And on the partnership side, we work with community-rooted organizations. So these are organizations that really understand the needs and solutions that are already kind of built into communities because of their lived experience, because of their deep rootedness in these communities for decades. And they typically, what we've seen is that they see a need for capital in the community and they want to fill that need in non-extractive ways and in non-traditional ways. And so this need can either be because traditional finance has been extractive in their communities sometimes, or not even present in those communities as well. Sometimes also, as we've talked a little bit about the definition between like risk and return, the traditional finance and funders deem their communities too risky because they're basing their assessments on credit scores or lack of collateral, which I think is something that we want to question as we do the work that we do. So Common Future supports organizations who have developed these deep relationships with community, who already provide technical assistance to small businesses, cooperatives, creatives, et cetera, by co-creating lending terms and underwriting criteria that are very different to what we see in traditional finance and really focusing on that co-creation piece, understanding what the community needs, bringing in potential borrowers, having the lending partner that we're working with really influence what we can build together. And then we also provide the back office services that are needed to implement the loan fund. Because what we found also is that a lot of the time it takes a lot of compliance or regulatory work, like back end work, as well as like specific systems to do lending that allows us to also build in flexibility for the borrower that allows us to ensure that the loans and that the servicing process and the origination process for these loans is dignified and that the borrower really feels like there's someone on the other side rather than working with a financial institution who only sees them, or a traditional financial institution who only might see them as a number or as like a countdown on how much is left to repay on a loan.
Thank you. That's amazing. And I've been a longtime fan and partner with Common Future Chelsea, I want to go into a little bit more about these concepts of risk and return. And you talked about that in the earlier segment. And I think first, let's maybe define this for the audience, because I think what they might be hearing is what risk and return is, not maybe the same thing that we're talking about when we talk about traditional finance, right? So when we talk about risk, you know, there's this notion in finance that risk is my job as somebody managing your money is to make you the most money possible by making sure that I'm making bets, and I call them bets, on things that are actually going to either get you to a financial goal or, quite frankly, surpass that financial goal. Because part of how I get paid is how much money I make for you, right? So the incentive of making sure that by any means necessary, I'm making as much money as possible for you, which means I'm making as much money as possible for me, right? So we don't talk about that, but it's kind of an inherent conflict of interest that nobody talks about in the finance sector. But also this idea of return, you know, when we talk about venture capital that are looking, when they make an investment, they want a 30 times return off of their money. So in simple terms, if I give you $1,000, I'm expecting you to pay me $300,000, right? That is what I'm hoping to get from my investment. Or private equity, they might be looking at a 10 times or 10x return. So give me your thoughts and opinions on just that whole structure and how that really what are the circumstances that kind of structure creates?
Yeah. I mean, at its core, that's just really based on extraction, right? You're getting more out of a system than you put in. You know, at the end of the day, that has to come from somewhere. And the last thing we want to see is that coming from these communities that we're particularly focused on, who are experiencing the greatest racial wealth gap. And that's because of systems and systemic pressures that have extracted from or denied access to wealth, community wealth accumulation, right? And so that's risk that shows up looking like bias, shows up looking like higher rates, no access to loans. You know, I think Christina mentioned a little bit earlier, the three things we kind of focus on are access, affordability, and power. And so we really try to tackle risk and return from those three areas. So with, you know, affordability and access, it's like meeting people where they're at. And instead of assessing risk as maybe just a credit score, it's really about better terms than that. And I think in something we'll probably talk about a little bit later, we've done that a number of ways. We've done it based on character-based lending, which is something we can get into, but basically looking at other criteria of how we know and understand trustworthiness, and really not even just we as Common Future, but how our community partners, being the leaders, understand that, okay, there's a good chance this person will pay this back, and the money that's going to them is going to positive impact in the community. I think that's an area around access and making sure it's also affordable. I think that was the second piece I said, and really not looking at these extractive rates that we see time and time again with these communities. And then power is finally the last piece, right? And I think that is a huge piece of risk and return. And so I think that comes down to like the dynamics of lending, but also, you know, are you taking away power when you're extracting more from the system than you put in, when you're extracting so much so from a community that's already been heavily divested, extracted from? What does that kind of do to power? And oftentimes it puts it in the hand of a traditional investor having more power and not returning value or power to the community. So we try to challenge that notion how we structure our lending.
Right. And I think also thinking about, you know, where some of the wealth has come from, right? When I remember I was working in Indian country for several years, and when I started to do research around some of the big foundations or some of the big Fortune 500 companies, and you look back historically of like how they made their money, we have one big philanthropic organization, the generator of the foundation or the creator of the foundation made their money in timber. And all the way from Minnesota all the way to the Pacific Northwest. And part of that timber mining was removing indigenous people from their lands, right? And so when we think about all this wealth was made off of removing people, harming people, where is the obligation, if any, right? Where is the obligation to undo some of that harm, right? So I totally hear you when we think about this concept of risk and with the concept of return, how can it be reimagineered to be like, I think you pointed out earlier, what's the risk if we don't do this? Does this community continue to evolve? Does this community continue to experience brain drain? Does this community continue to experience economic devastation because we've extracted all of the resources, meaning time, talent, treasure, out of it, and now there's nothing left, and everyone's sitting around wondering why it's a barren desert, right? Whether that's physically or metaphorically, right? So what do you see are maybe some of the challenges when putting together character-based lending, understanding that people have to really exercise a great amount of transparency and a great amount of sharing of information that is really quite personal? What are some of the things that would you say to either a borrower or to an emerging fund that's really looking to get into character-based lending?
I think to your earlier point about building trust, I think that's such a huge piece. And I know Christina can speak to this in a little bit more detail because she and I have talked about this at length, but you're starting not only with, like you're coming in with a very different product, but you're coming into a space where people have a lot of trauma, right? And I think you talked about that previously and you know, us sharing a little bit about our own, but I think we're talking about generations of community trauma around finance. And now we're bringing something new into that, that can just, you know, give people pause immediately. And so I think the beautiful thing is that we've worked with organizations that already have trust and understand what things are meaningful and can ask those, I think, in culturally responsive ways, are in community with people. And so there's more ease there around that. But I think there's still an opportunity for education around, like, why are we asking certain things and how might those be different? How does that inform things if there's a collective that decides on things, if there's a, you know, different set of underwriting criteria, even just explaining, you know, some of how the underwriting process works maybe differently from a traditional underwriting process, and how it's really an opportunity for folks to kind of shine and show what we know to be true, right? And what I think our community-led programs know to be true, that these communities are so worthy of this funding, but that the traditional system doesn't give them a space to shine. And so this is what it is. So I think that encourages people to show up and speak honestly about, like, oh yeah, these are the ways that I do have strong community ties. I know there's demand because of these maybe non-traditional things. And it gives us a chance to really hear and elevate that.
One thing I'd love to add too is one of the challenges I think we saw early on was around this transfer of trust. One of the things that we strive to work kind of in is in partnership with other organizations who already have trust within a community, because I think we have a very deep understanding of, like, not coming in as a quote unquote lender and then having people automatically trust us because they have had that some, like, trauma around other lenders, around other financial institutions. And so we really rely on our partners to, like, help us build that trust with folks. And initially it can be a little scary. It can be a little difficult for people to see kind of an email come in and say, hey, this is, like, your lender and this is what your payment's going to be. And I think, like, being transparent. And then also I just want to, like, shout out our investment operations team who works really, really diligently on the back end to support borrowers in so many ways. So when our borrowers have difficulty repaying, we pull in resources from our lending partner who can help them, like, in non-capital related ways by supporting with their business planning, by supporting with like dealing with some of those challenges. But then on our lending side, we're able to offer deferrals. We're able to restructure those loans to really make sure that the borrower knows, hey, we're here for you. We want you to be successful in this repayment. We're not here to get you because you didn't repay or report it to the credit bureaus as such. And so I think over time, we see that trust building a lot more with us. But, like, initially, it is a challenge. And we really appreciate our partners for helping kind of, like, transfer that trust. And when we develop relationships with our partners, I think that is something that we want to come across initially as well.
Yeah, and I will just tell you, the founders really appreciate it. And so that's and I've talked with some of our other colleagues who are doing similar work, and that's really the gold star. And one of the things that when people ask about what's our impact metric with ConnectUp, it's really about that they're ready for traditional capital. Because quite frankly, there's not enough of this kind of capital available. So I don't want to get them ready for this kind of capital, knowing that the universe of this kind of capital is so small still. I know you all are working on that and making it the pie bigger, but let's get you ready for the system that's waiting for you, right? Yes, all of us are working diligently to make change, but it's not here yet. So let's get you ready for traditional capital. And that's another reason why our terms are very short. We call it like, you know, on the job training or college, right? You're going to make, this is the place where you can safely make all the mistakes so that when you go to your next line of credit, and quite frankly, you're going for bigger amounts of money. You might be getting $50,000 from us, but now you're ready to get $200,000 because you're ready to scale up and hire 10 more employees. And that's really the goal. Well, as we wrap up, any upcoming projects or initiatives that we can look forward to from Common Future?
Yeah, I think one thing that I'm personally excited to share more about is new lending partnerships in the works. I think we've been in the background this first half of the year, really refining a lot of our processes and beginning to like understand how we design loan programs with our partners. And so as we begin to implement some of those, I'm definitely excited to see what our partners come up with in terms of terms and underwriting criteria that's different and that really fit the needs of the communities that we're serving.
Chelsea, what are you most excited about?
I think what's most exciting to me is that we are at Common Future are really, I think, getting a little bit more refined or precise about who and what we're focusing on. And I think that's in an environment where there is some sort of, you know, there's some backlash, I guess, like DEI broadly and stuff. And we're affirming time and time again that we are deeply committed to Black and Indigenous communities and prioritizing the impact in BIPOC communities. And I think that just that feels very exciting, and the possibilities there feel really exciting. So we're looking forward to what that means in this environment to continue to invest in these communities.
Thank you. You're listening to Do Different Better with your host, Elaine Rasmussen. Coming up next, we'll be talking about the work of Common Future and how they are bringing innovation and economic justice to finance. Awesome.
All right.
Only a little bit left, y'all. You're listening to Do Different Better with your host, Elaine Rasmussen. Coming up, we're now going to be talking about Common Future and how they are bringing innovation and economic justice to finance. So over the break, we were chopping it up, and we were talking about a couple of things. One, we were talking about how this kind of work really requires a lot to ensure success, right? We were calling it the cost of success versus risk. Chelsea was talking about, the risk, you know, of what if we don't do something? Let's talk about like the cost of success and what does that mean and what does that look like? When we look at someone like Theranos, who was able to raise $900 million for a product that didn't exist, and we have all of these emerging fund managers trying to raise money to do this community work and make sure that capital stays in the community, but they can't even raise $5 million. You know, tell me what are your thoughts about that? What have you experienced? What have you heard? And why is it important that your model of keeping the capital in the community is so important?
Yeah, I think in terms of the keeping capital in community, we really think that when we're lending, the reason why our rates are from 0 to 3% is because we feel like profits need to stay in the community. If a business is thriving, if a business is hiring more folks, making more revenue, they're able to continue to support their community, that profit can be reinvested into growing jobs, into growing products and services that, frankly, when entrepreneurs of color develop something, it's because they see a true need within their community. And like bringing that and allowing the profits to stay within community, I think, is so important, rather than extracting them out through fees, through interest rates, and then like bringing that capital back to investors. We kind of take a different view and like want that capital to stay within community. I think to your other point, there is kind of a large cost to this. Our back office services do require a lot of costs that we have to pay for as a nonprofit, that we're kind of like, frankly, questioning, like, whose responsibility is it to pay that? Do we go to philanthropy and ask them to match some of their contributions to funds, to also understand like what it takes? Because if we weren't here, I think folks would have to stand up loan funds themselves, which is costly, or go to other traditional fund managers that might charge a lot more to be providing services that might not even give the lending partner the power, choice, and ownership over the decision-making power. So I think there's a lot to consider around who takes on the cost of what we're doing. And then also, how do we not pass that on to the borrower? Because that is kind of extracting profits out of the hard work that they've been putting into their businesses, to their creative endeavors, to cooperatives who are providing such important services and programs in communities.
Chelsea, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I'll just add to that, that I think part of what we're trying to do is a corrective action, right? I think a lot of the cost of doing this work right now sits with first-time fund managers, emerging fund managers. And so that's raising the funds, that's, you know, building out all the assets to do that, that's tracking all the pilot. And of course, I feel like it's not a matter of ability. I think it's an issue of where does that typically sit, right? And how can we, as investors and partners, be taking some of that back and say, you know, that should actually sit with some of us. So if we're doing a due diligence process, or if we're doing a fundraising, if you're undertaking a fundraising process, we know lots of other people who are aligned. You know, there aren't many of us organizations, but we know the ones that are aligned. Mm-hmm. How are we also talking to them? How are we informally and formally helping to organize and help you stack capital? How are we helping to bring in technical assistance providers when that's what's needed? How are we lessening the burden of kind of the design and due diligence process if we're looking at the intermediated side of things and less so the partnership side? But I think we're looking at all those different touch points, and what you often see and what you traditionally see, right, is that that sits with the first-time fund manager. And that just feels wholly inappropriate and unbalanced. And so I think that's something at every step of the way that we're trying to figure out who holds that and how do we shift that back, oftentimes to us or to philanthropy.
And so what is the role of philanthropy and or the private sector and really playing a role in exponentially driving social impact or economic change that works for everyone?
Yeah, I think the role of philanthropy, to bring it back to something we talked about at the beginning around participation and participatory investing, is I think the first role is to listen to community, to really be have listening ears and bring people to the table and provide the resources and the access that they need to be at the table effectively, because of the long history of exclusion that kind of has happened in these kind of spaces. So I think that would be my answer, is like, first and foremost, like, listen to the partners, like, understand what they need, and then act accordingly and like stick to your commitments.
So Chelsea, let's dig into that a little bit. What exactly do we mean by giving them what they need, right? Because I think people hear that and they're like, oh, well, we had Jimmy John's sandwiches there. Like, what do you mean? Like, so what does it mean to give people what they need and resources to show up?
Yeah, I mean, I think that can look like per diems and stuff for participation and compensating people for their time and truly like expertise. I think that can also look like meeting folks where they're at in terms of place, but also what timing and situation looks right for them to be able to fully participate, whether that's like additional care, childcare, and things like that. But just truly making a meeting space that I think and a gathering space that people can actually come to and be fully present in. I think it's also investing in doing some unlearning, whether you're on the side of an intermediary like us or in philanthropy, and really understanding where bias and power show up and how that's, you're bringing that into the room and how we can mitigate that to make that a space where folks can show up more fully and tell you honestly, you know, what the challenges are and what's needed. And then I think folks showing up with like abundance when we're funding these things, unfortunately, like you said, folks are struggling to raise, you know, their first fund, $1-5 million, however many. And I think we need like intermediaries and philanthropy to show up really abundantly. And so that looks like multi-year long-term grants to help support the folks who are managing these funds, in addition to investing in the fund early on and bringing your friends along with that, right? Like that feels more abundant than just, you know, well, maybe we'll come in a little bit later, but and still operating from that space of like risk and fear, instead saying like, we're in, we're excited, and this is what it looks like for us to show up with, you know, just an outpouring of the type of support you need, hopefully in response to all of that deep listening that Christina said earlier.
Well, thank you to both of you for being my guests on the show. You are my first official guest. So thank you, thank you, thank you for being my little guinea pigs. I really appreciate you and adore both of you. You're amazing humans that I get to share space with. And I'm just so proud to be in partnership with not only you all as individuals, but Common Future as an organization. I think they're just doing an amazing work. For our audience, let me know what you think about our show. If there's a finance question that you have, or if there's someone you want me to interview, hit me up in my DMs or on our website. We've just wrapped up talking with Chelsea McDaniel, Director of Impact Investing, and Christina La Agudelo, Manager of Lending Partnerships of Common Future. I can't wait for next week's conversation, where we're going to be talking about what actually is social finance, who it impacts, and why it's important to you.